Okay, well, this is basically a dynamics-oriented talk. So the topic is going to be what we call resonant relaxation, which is something which operates in this context in nearly Keplerian potentials most strongly. And so, for example, in galactic nuclei, we have a black hole that can be important. So let me, to describe resonant relaxation, let me just review what do we all know and love about two-body or non-resonant relaxation. And you know, this comes in various guises, like dynamical friction and in the context of, you know, globular clusters, say, you know, mass segregation and so forth. And the fundamental quantity that is going to sort of best illustrate what resonant relaxation does is in terms of just the relaxation time itself, the time scale on which you know, the stars in the nucleus sort of forget their initial energy and angular momentum. So let me actually, to make it clear what's different about resonant relaxation, let me actually go through the order of magnitude argument to derive the relaxation time for the two-body case. So you can just consider a cluster of stars. So you have n stars of a certain size. And if you consider a particular star and a small region around that star, and you want to calculate the fluctuating force felt by that star on this smaller scale, r, then basically there's going to be some Poissonian fluctuation in the number of stars in that little sphere. And so that leads to a fluctuating force of this form, where the number of stars, this fluctuating mass, is just given the square root of the total number of stars there, just Poissonian fluctuation. And that acts over a time scale, which is set by the size of this little region. And so on this time scale, you get a certain impulse like that. And then what's crucial about normal two-body relaxation is that these fluctuations are not correlated on time scales longer than delta T. And therefore, the RMS change in the velocity of any particular star turns out to be something like this. And when you work through, so the order of magnitude, what you notice about this is that it's this R, this radius R, has dropped out of here. And so when you ask what's the fluctuation over all scales, that's where you get that Coulomb logarithm from, being scale independent. And so now if we turn this around and ask what's the relaxation time, which is the time scale on which the RMS fluctuations are of order the velocity of the stars themselves, you get something like this. And you know, you can put in numbers. And generally for galactic nuclei, we don't make a big deal out of relaxation itself, because the time scales are generally much longer than the Hubble time. And so you're used to considering relaxation to be not a particularly important dynamical effect. Whereas in globular clusters, on the other hand, where it can be short, that's where you can get dramatic things like quark collapse and so forth. And along with this, just because it is sort of a random process, it's a slow diffusion for the two-body case, both the energy and the angular momentum increase as square root of t in this case. So now what's going to be different for the resonant case is that
your capital M is either the mass of the
it's the total mass
or the mass of the central black hole.
Yeah. On this view graph, M is just the total mass of the system, which could be either the stars or the black hole or in between.
Right.
But now if you assume that for the resonant case, we'll have to assume that the black hole is dominating the potential. And the point is that I'll just a brief note on where the name comes from. I guess one thing that sort of confuses people about, they sort of confuse resonant with resonance. So in other words, what I'm going to describe is not coming about because of stars in resonance with each other. It has to do with resonance structure of the potential itself. And Keplerian potential is one example, but there are also more general potentials where you can get what we would call resonant relaxation. Yeah, that's not a bad word, actually. I mean, it's, I guess it's, you know, calling it resonant sort of can confuse some people. And what's even more confusing is that if you go in certain limits, if you try to really push resonant relaxation to the, you know, most general potentials, then what you have to start doing is putting the stars into resonant positions to have it to work at all. You know, so that they need, you have to do that to support the non-resonant potential. And so, I mean, it gets sort of complicated in that way. But so, I mean, so we won't worry about that. So, I mean, it's where it's most important is the Keplerian case, where the resonant structure in this case is first the spherical symmetry, and then the fact that the orbits are closed. And if you think of that in terms of sort of action angle variables, there's sort of fundamental frequencies of the potential itself, and so one, say the theta, which is sort of motion out of the plane. Since there's planar motion, there's zero frequency there, and the radial and azimuthal frequencies are the same for Kepler. And why that's important is because now this fluctuating force is coherent over time scales, which are much longer than the orbital time, say. And they act about the same for, I mean, it's coherent over a time scale of the precession time scale. And if the precession time scale is set by the stars themselves, so the stars are the perturbing force, then, you know, this is sort of the expression for what the precession time scale is. And if you ask, so what does this mean? How does this modify two-body relaxation? So the way you can get at that is to imagine averaging, take some intermediate time scale, which is between the orbital time scale and this longer precession time scale, and then you average out to get the mean potential over that intermediate time scale. And so what you end up with in the nearly Keplerian case, you get a point mass, you know, the black hole, which we'll assume is just fixed at the center, plus you get these elliptical wires, essentially, due to the, when you average out the stellar orbits. And so what does that do? I mean, if you consider that, since the potential, you know, these wires are essentially stationary over this time scale, that means that there's no resonant component to the energy relaxation, so it doesn't change energy relaxation time. However, there is a coherent torque on the orbits, which acts over the precession time, and what that means now is that angular momentum of the orbits no longer diffuses, no longer a random walk process on those timescales, but there's a systematic change to it. And what that means is that the angular momentum relaxation timescale is now can be much shorter than the energy relaxation. So two-body, they used to be the same. They used to be equal, and for galactic nuclei, you know, generally much longer than Hubble time, but now you can get the angular momentum relaxation time to be shorter than a Hubble time, even if energy relaxation is not important. And this just sort of works out what the order of magnitude estimate. I mean, you can compute sort of estimate what the torque is on a typical orbit. And I guess one of the important things to notice is that in contrast, you know, there's no Coulomb logarithm in this case, because in contrast to the two-body case where there's sort of scale-free thing, in this case, the resonant torque is dominated by the largest scale mass fluctuation in the system. So it's sort of an inherently global phenomenon of the system itself, which is one thing that makes it actually difficult to calculate numerically when you want to get hard numbers out of it. But anyway,
as long as all of the wires are more or less the same radius, if there is a wide range of scales of radius of wires, is that still true that it's dominated?
No, I think it's still true. Yeah, I mean, it's really, yeah, we really didn't make any assumptions about about the range of the system. I mean, it's really feeling the largest fluctuation around, basically, that it can get a hold on. I mean, if it's, now you have to worry about, you know, how is the precession time, if the precession time changes a lot over these radius, then, you know, you have to think about that, but modulo that. So anyway, so on scales, you know, shorter than this precession time, you get just a systematic change in the angular momentum, and then it goes back to being a random walk on longer time scales. Okay, so you can think of, there's sort of essentially, in L space, there's sort of a mean-free path for this diffusion, then on longer scales in that space, and then it goes back to a random walk. And so you can turn this again into a relaxation time, and
so that's what really gives you the conditional potential, is just the precession time is interesting long.
Right. So, or in other words, I mean, the mass fraction of the stars is small, relatively small.
Right. That's why a separate black hole matters so much.
Right. Right. And I guess, you know, there are two expressions here. If you notice, if you put in this expression for the precession time into this one, then what you find out is that this is always small after precession time. So when you want to figure out the relaxation time, there's only one case, and there's not two possible cases. And so you do that, and to order of magnitude, this is what you're getting. In terms of the original two-body relaxation time, the resonant time is down by of order the mass fraction, except there's this pesky Coulomb logarithm here from the two-body formula. And this actually turns out to limit the importance of resonant relaxation in typical cases, because if this is, say, sort of factor of 10 or something in a galactic nucleus, then that means that resonant relaxation isn't really going to be important until the mass fraction is at least a tenth instead of order unity. Okay, so that actually in sort of the possible consequences for galactic nuclei, which I'll show you, I mean, that really tends to sort of limit the importance of it. You know, it could have been more important if not for, you know, this, the fact that resonant relaxation doesn't have this Coulomb logarithm, because it's only determined by this larger scale fluctuation, not by an integration over all scales. And I guess the other thing to notice, and this turns out to affect both the scalar and, in this case, the vector and scalar angular momentum. Whereas if you go to more general potentials now, so suppose it's not near the Keplerian, but it's spherical, which could be a model for a globular cluster, for example. In that case, what happens, if you imagine averaging again over this intermediate time scale, then instead of the wires, you get sort of phonograph records. And in that case, the torques are perpendicular to the orbit normals, and so the scalar angular momentum is no longer resonant relaxed. Only the vector is, which means that it increases the rate that the orbit sort of precesses around. But, you know, if it's spherically symmetric before, it'll still be spherically symmetric afterwards. And so it's not clear in that case that it's of any importance, basically. I mean, it's faster, but I guess we didn't really see how that would sort of do anything interesting in that case. And so let's just, well, I guess before I get into the Yeah.
You've been speaking about the angular momentum vector. Can you make similar remarks about the lens vector, and is that an interesting thing to do?
Well, I guess we didn't consider it, but I guess in what context would that be dynamically important?
Oh, I don't know. The nucleus of M31, where there may be some type of eccentric thing going on,
I guess we haven't. I can't say, but I mean, that's sort of an interesting question. Let me just convince you that this this actually works in practice. I mean, these are some numerical simulations that we did to test this. So here's for four different test stars in a Kepler potential perturbed by some other stars. And so I'm plotting the change in energy, scalar, angular momentum, and vector angular momentum of these four particles. And so what you can see is that systematically the energies, and if you work out the slopes here, I mean, they do average out to T to the 1/2 change. So those are still random walking, whereas the angular momentums are both systematically increasing at nearly linearly, okay? So now if you contrast this with suppose we just do a non-Keplerian but spherical potential, then in this case it's an isochrome potential, which I can write down for you if you want. But so here we expect that, just like I argued before, in this case the scalar angular momentum now is now random walking again, although the vector L is still increasing closer linearly. Okay, so this actually seems to work in practice like the order of magnitude argument suggests. So now if we go back now and concentrate on sort of Kepler potentials, like for a black hole in a nucleus, then what might that do? So one of the consequences here is resonant friction, which is, take dynamical friction, which is just a particular case of two-body relaxation, and then you add the resonant relaxation. And using a complicated formalism, which I don't really, I'm not an expert in, you can sort of derive what the resonant part of the torque is. And this sort of comes from Lyndon Bell and Kalnas sort of formalism.
Just like plasma physics.
I guess so. If I knew plasma physics, maybe. But anyway, so I just put this up here just to give some basis for the conclusions, which I'll refer you to the paper if you want to know more details. But basically, the point is that you can have resonant friction, and the most important possible consequence is what it does for the eccentricity of, for example, a black hole binary. Now, I guess we've talked about this sum, you know, that the binary can sort of get hung up at a state where outside the radius, where gravitational radiation can shrink the orbit, and so it'll sort of hang there a while. But if the orbits were very eccentric, you know, if dynamical friction itself could make the orbits very eccentric, then that could be a way of getting past that hump. And in the past, you know, putting resonant relaxation aside, I mean, people have, there's been some argument about whether dynamical friction is going to predominantly increase or decrease the eccentricity of orbits in general. And I think at this point, the general conclusion is that you'd expect it to decrease to make the orbits generally more circular and keep the eccentricity low, okay, and so that, you know, it would get hung up. But now in this case, it actually is possible in the resonant case for the eccentricity to increase significantly. And the way that comes about is that if the cluster itself is basically, the orbit of the binary is going to follow what the bias that the stars have. So if the stars are predominantly radial, it's going to make the binary more radial. And if it's more circular, then it's going to make the binary more circular. And that comes about sort of from this term here. Just F is the distribution function of the stars in this cluster. And so if it's isotropic, for example, where this is zero, then there's no resonant torque. So there's no resonant friction in that case. But otherwise, the sign of the torque just follows that of the bias of the stars themselves. And this sort of gives how much of a change that can make. And it's sort of another one of these, in terms of the regular dynamical friction decay rate, you get another one of these sort of mass ratio things. And I can show you one example that of a numerical simulation. This is done by from Quinlan in one of his binary black hole papers. And so what this graph is showing, so the different panels are for different mass ratios for the black holes. And so this, the mass ratio gets closer to unity as you go this way. And so this would be the most resonant system, most nearly Keplerian, and this least. And the different curves here are the background galaxy potential has different anisotropies, okay, ranging from highly radial to highly tangentially biased. And so here what he plots is, as a function, as the orbit of the binary evolves, how does the eccentricity change? And what you can see here is that these are the radially biased models, and so you can see that over time, the radially biased models become highly eccentric. In the case where the mass ratio is small, where it's very nearly Keplerian, which is where you expect the resonant friction to be strongest, whereas in the lower case here, which is the only thing that's basically changed is the mass ratio, then resonant friction is weaker, it's too weak, and they all get sent to low eccentricity, which is sort of the default condition, you know, that he's arguing happens most of the time. And so I guess this is the only simulation I know of which has tried to numerically check the resonant friction part. And it's, I mean, this code itself is, I mean, doing these kind of things are very hard again because it's a global phenomenon. I mean, it's, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that, you know, the Fokker-Planck equation, which has been used, you know, back for many years to do some, you know, a lot of the dynamical simulations for galaxies isn't valid in this case. I mean, that has built into it, you know, diffusion in both energy and angular momentum, and that's just not valid in this system. And so you sort of have to toss out your Fokker-Planck code. And at this point, there's sort of no replacement for Fokker-Planck, and which means that you're driven to use sort of particle-based simulation methods, which are, you know, which are obviously a lot harder to do.
There can't be some new improved Fokker-Planck in which you have different diffusion rates in different directions.
I think it should be possible to modify the Fokker-Planck equation to take account of this, but and I guess, you know, Scott looked at that a little bit and sort of didn't see anything obvious, so I mean it's not been done to my knowledge, but it should be possible.
You mean the general diffusion? Isn't the problem more fundamental than that, in that you're dealing with something that's essentially non-Markovian here?
Yeah, that's right. It's not a diffusion. I mean, I think that's what he meant. You mean modify the Fokker-Planck too?
I mean, technically, it's easy to include other diffusion coefficients.
No, but I mean, somehow choose different diffusion coefficients in different directions in phase.
But it's not a, I mean, it's not diffusion, though.
But the problem is it's not Markovian. I mean, the Fokker-Planck comes from a sort of mastery equation.
Of course, yes. Yeah. But I guess that's what I'm missing. Is there a long tail somewhere or something?
Well, I mean, that's what I thought was the problem here with these resonance processes that's going on over many, many periods, and that there's something intrinsically non-Markovian in this.
I mean, it's not a diffusion is the point. It's not a random walk.
I might make the same comment about the stock market, Fokker-Planck equation.
It winds up being a random walk with a longer time scale.
Yeah, but they're important dynamics on that operate on the smaller scales, though. So I mean, I guess it's So anyway, I mean, this is the only thing I know of. I don't really think that it's been well explored you know, how important this is going to be for black hole binaries. Certainly, it can't be important if they're comparable mass, because then they're never nearly Keplerian. That's the other problem. I mean, I guess their conclusion in this paper was basically that the amount of anisotropy was pretty large, and you probably wouldn't get that realistically. Exactly. I mean, in terms of like say the box orbits and such, like say for the elliptical galaxies, you're thinking they expect sort of tangential bias in the center. So I mean that's. So I think it's probably, on those lines, you would argue that it's unlikely that this would happen often, I mean, if at all. But certainly, you know, in principle, the effect is there.
It could happen if you had gas at large radius with contrived to have no angular momentum, forming essentially radius the inwards and able to form stars.
Yes, right.
On the inflow timescale.
Right.
Therein is the problem in some sense.
Yeah. Okay, so that's one. Let's see, is there anything else here? Well, I guess I can just mention that I concentrate on the eccentricity there, but if you have, say, a rotating system, you can also get some resonant effect for, and say the orbit of the massive object is inclined relative to the invariant plane of the rotating system. You can also get resonant friction, which degrades the inclination quickly, just like the eccentricity in the other case. And that's probably more important for, say, something like, you know, planetary formation, where you have a sort of an accreting protoplanet or something, which if it gets brought into sort of this plane, then it's, you know, can accrete faster because it's sort of aligned better. But that's a different matter. Right.
This would strongly argue that black hole binaries are going to be really certain.
Yeah.
I mean.
If that's the case, I mean, then.
I mean, the effect drives you towards circularity. Mm-hmm. It really guarantees that they're going to be certain.
Right. And again, I mean, but remember that this doesn't really operate unless the binaries are there's a large mass ratio between the two. So you have a small galaxy, you know, plunging into a bigger one. The effect which I think has sort of the largest probability of actually being seen observationally would be in terms of controlling the anisotropy in a visible region of the core itself. And here the idea is that because of this disparity in time scales between the energy and angular momentum, it's perfectly possible, and indeed, you know, it does happen in galaxies, we see that there are regions in the nucleus where this condition holds, where this is the Hubble time. And the point is, that means that it's going to be totally relaxed in angular momentum space, but even though it can hold its initial conditions, so to speak, in terms of the energy. And so what happens in that case is basically that the distribution function of the stars is put into a known state based on the constraints of the total angular momentum and the initial energy distribution of the stars themselves. So for example, if the core is non-rotating, then what this guarantees in this region is that the cluster has to be isotropic. Okay. And this is, you know, this is now assuming that relaxation is the dominant effect. I mean, if there's lots of other stuff going on, then you have to take that into account too. And in particular, this statement sort of also ignores tidal disruptions, for example, which I'll get to, which is going to force anisotropies on, you know, very small L. And again, I'm just emphasizing that all of this sort of violates Fokker-Planck. And just to give you sort of an idea for what the scales are for this. Here's a little chart on some of the numbers for some real galaxies. So what these columns show are, first off, mu is the mass ratio, and remember that resonant relaxation is probably not important for mass ratios above 0.1. So this is the angular size that we would see in arc seconds, where this mass ratio is at the interesting 0.1, and you can see that we certainly do get to that scale, even with current observations for a number of galaxies. If we go to sort of HST limiting resolutions of 0.1 arc seconds and ask what's the mass ratio there, then again it's much less than 1. And this compares the resonant and non-resonant relaxation timescales at 0.1 arc seconds. And the interesting one, I guess, in terms of can we see this possible ratio of anisotropy, if you look at the last column, this is the observed angular size at which this time scale is 10 to the 10 years. Okay. So if you can resolve down to here, and so I guess the best case in this case would be M31, where, you know, HST is sort of actually close to the point where getting into that regime, where even though the energy time, relaxation time, is again much longer than the age of the universe, and the angular momentum is sort of right there. Now, of course, M31 is sort of a, you know, complicated nucleus, but I think it does make it. I think the point is that, especially with, you know, if you think ahead to these, you know, space-based interferometers and such, if you're really trying to model accurately the dynamics of the nucleus on these scales, that you're going to get the data that you really have to take this into account.
This was looking like a good argument for these FFE LZ models that they're using to model these galaxies. If they are good models, but in fact that may not be true. They may have to consider anisotropic models, right? Because you're not down to this point for resonance.
Not for most of them. I mean, it's sort of marginal. Yeah, I mean, here it's marginal, and certainly not for these guys. It's on this basis. I don't think you can argue for that sort of distribution.
Yeah. For M31, can you remind us on what scale this doublet structure is visible?
That's like half an arc second or something, isn't it? I think.
Yeah. In the case of our galactic center, You specialize the one arc second, but we've been discussing a relatively small number of stars on smaller angular scales.
Right.
What are the corresponding old fashioned dynamical friction time scales and resonant relaxation time scales for that small group of select stars?
Oh, well, I guess the thing to. Let's see, is that right? If I remember right, for our galactic center, when you go to the smaller radii, the problem is that even the normal two-body relaxation time is less than a Hubble time.
Yes.
And so if you ask what happens in that case, that's when you have to know how to fix Fokker-Planck, basically, to get a self-consistent.
Well, remember, the size you're looking at is probably much younger than a Hubble time.
Right. I guess that's.
So the stars were formed probably less than the dynamical.
Right. Now, is it probably less than it's probably less younger than the relaxation time as well.
Less than the two-body relaxation time, but not necessarily
Right.
less than the resonant relaxation time.
Right. I haven't actually worked out that number. It goes basically at the math. I mean, you know, we can figure it out if you think you know what the two-body relaxation time is, then you just take the multiply by the mass ratio, and you get sort of an estimate, you know, times 10, and then you sort of estimate this number. So, I mean, what's the two-body relaxation time for the cluster we're considering? I mean, it's V cubed over M rho.
I mean, you would have said, you know, decades to centuries, and if you take over a log in of those,
right, I mean, it's...
We might be talking about, we don't know, because we don't get to see the right ones, so we don't know what they
are. Right.
Well, if it, you know, if it were 1,000 stars, then all logs are 10, so it would be 100 decades or whatever. So that would be, you know, 1,000.
Well, I guess we'd have, I mean, but you have to get a handle on the, I guess we don't really have a handle on what's the two-body, what's the age relative to the two-body relaxation time. I mean, that's the first thing to figure out, I guess.
Well, with Andrea Gers and Michael and Gengel and
so right.
Those numbers may be forthcoming.
Right.
You know.
Oh, yeah, I mean, then, and I mean, if they're younger than that, then I mean, I guess it's, yeah, it is possible that, I mean, I would expect, I mean, the mass ratio is pretty small there, so, or, I mean, you wouldn't see the black hole otherwise, so. Okay. Yeah. I mean, that could be an interesting number, though. Yeah. Okay. So I mean. So anyway, I mean. Probably not. I mean, now I think we're probably okay that, you know, you can sort of pass over this effect as far as dynamical modeling for with the current data. But I mean, you know, if you really go towards sort of milliarcsecond things, then I think if you want to get it right, you sort of have to deal with this. Well, the final effect that I want to talk about would be the resonant tidal disruption. And you know, this is again, tidal disruption is something that's controlled by angular momentum relaxation, and so this is something that is changed significantly in this situation. Okay, so just my one sentence, one line review of loss cone dynamics. So, I mean, there's a tidal radius as long as the black hole mass is less than, say, 10 to the 8th, 10 to the 9 solar masses, then, at least for main sequence stars, you know, there's a tidal radius outside the horizon, so the stars will get disrupted inside there, and you can recast that in terms of angular momentum space as stellar orbits which, whose L is less than some minimum value set by the tidal radius, sort of lie in the loss cone, and if they stay in the loss cone for an orbital period, they're going to be disrupted. And when you're talking about to figure out the dynamics of the loss cone, just think of the non-resonant, the two-body case now. The important parameter is sort of this Q parameter, which measures the ratio of how much angular momentum change per orbit there is relative to the size of the loss cone itself. And so if this ratio is large, for example, then you're in what's called the full loss cone limit or the pinhole limit, where dynamically the loss cone itself isn't very important because the stars can just diffuse right across it in one orbit, and so they don't stay there long enough to get disrupted. And in that case, if you talk about what's the fraction of stars at a given energy which are disrupted per orbital period, in that limit it's just the ratio of the area of the loss cone to the total area in L space. And the other limit, which is sort of the empty loss cone limit or the diffusion limit, where Q is much less than 1, then you can, say, solve your Fokker-Planck equation and so forth, and you get a different answer. And in terms of what sets the total disruption rate in the nucleus as a whole, it tends to be dominated by the critical radius or critical energy, which is sort of the marginally full loss cone case, and I'll give you some numbers coming up on what that turns out to be in typical galaxies. So anyway, how does this change in the resin case? Well, in the full lodestone case, the lodestone itself isn't dynamically important to start with. So the fact that you've added more relaxation doesn't really make any difference either. And so the disruption rates are stays the same in that case. But in the other case, where before in the two-body case you have just a slow diffusion in L. In this case, in the resonant case, since there's systematically larger, let me so let me just draw. So suppose we, you know, this is L space essentially, and your loss cone is down here. Then since you can consider the resonant empty loss cone case, instead of considering the stars moving around systematically, you can actually just think of the loss cone itself as moving around and sort of exploring the space. And since there's a systematic drift in that case, instead of a diffusion, then, you know, after an orbital period, maybe the loss cone will be over here. And so the fraction, you know, this lambda, this fraction of stars that are disrupted here, is of order, you know, this L min times this delta L orb divided by L max squared. And that's where that formula, order of magnitude estimate, comes from. So anyway, in fractional terms, comparing resonant and non-resonant, in the empty loss cone case, you go up by this factor of q to the minus a half, which is can be much, you know, in principle arbitrarily large if you go far enough in. And so I to show some numerical simulations of how that can affect the distribution function. This is a comparison between equivalent resonant and non-resonant clusters at several different energies or Q values. This is square root of Q. So these would be empty loss cone case, sort of marginally full and full loss cone. And so you can see, as just like the qualitative estimates, in the full loss cone case, it doesn't matter if it's resonant or non-resonant. The solid line is the resonant curve. But in the empty case, you can see there's a dramatic difference in terms of the angular momentum distribution function between the resonant, which is here, which has a much higher disruption rate compared to the non-resonant. Okay. But now, in terms of, if you ask how does this affect the total disruption rate for the nucleus as a whole, assuming that it's fully resonant, and there you get back to the point that since the disruptions are dominated by stars near the critical radius, which is the marginally full case, sort of here. And in this case, it's only order unity effect because it's mostly washed out. It only gives you sort of a factor of two, basically, increase in the overall disruption rate. So, I mean, this doesn't solve the problem of trying to use tidal disruptions to power bright quasars or anything like that, but it can sort of help support disruption power in say weaker objects. I mean, it does help in that case. Right. Well, again, it's first thing, you need to be near the Keplerian, so you need a good mass ratio for the binary. And in that case, yeah, I mean, I guess it's still
well,
there's still a loss.
If you had equal mass black holes, if you have star, and you're just sending stars.
Right, but I mean, if it's, you know, you're talking about the loss cone to scattering, basically,
yes,
for the binary black holes. But still, if you want to feed that by resonant relaxation, then the stars have to it has to feel like a nearly Kepler, it has to feel like a Keplerian potential. So if they're it's basically just all set by what's the precession, precession time. If the stars are of low enough energy that the binary is relatively, you know, looks sort of like almost like a point mass with some small, you know, quadrupole perturbation, then I guess that would still I don't know if that still holds. Is I assume that there's still a critical radius for the scattering loss cone as well, and if that works like here, then it would still be only order unity sort of effect in that case. But I don't think anybody has actually looked at, tried to do simulations or really look at that closely.
What about the collision, enhancing the collision frequency, Scalar's collision frequency?
Well, I think that's kind of random to, I guess I don't see why that would help it. I mean, it's all, I guess you're trying to think that they're wandering around faster and so that they could collide more frequently.
It seems to be like a whole lot of little tiny loss codes. So small, all probably in this rapid limit.
Offhand, I wouldn't.
You don't think it makes any difference to the stellar collision frequency?
I wouldn't think so, but I haven't sort of thought carefully about it. But let's see. What should we show? Well, this is just another example of showing on larger L scales, sort of near, closer to L max, the difference between resonant and non-resonant case. And so in these numerical simulations, I sort of reproduced the old result was that, and this is a semi-log plot, if you notice that the distribution function is a straight line, essentially, in semi-log space for the non-resonant case. And for this sort of somewhat empty loss cone, you can just see that how near the loss cone, you know, you've got the increase in density, and then it sort of here's the precession scale is a sort of 2 in terms of L, which means that it goes back to a random walk over here, and so that's sort of where the two curves go back together, basically. And here's just a graph of some numbers on, is this actually of any use in real galaxies? And it's not just a question of, you know, just to get that factor of 2, you have to, the nucleus has to be resonant at the critical radius. And looking at sort of the last column in the bottom table gives what that, my estimate sort of for these galaxies, what that mass fraction is. And you can see that for the large galaxies, it seems that they're not even nearly Keplerian at the critical radius. And for the other guys, you know, the smaller ones, it's a lot better, but you're still not at that sort of 0.1 value. And so even getting that factor of 2 is probably hard in practice. So let me just say a little bit about relativity and how that can make an impact here. Up to this point, we've been assuming that the precession time scale is set by the stars themselves, but if you're close enough to the black hole, then that's the GR effects are going to set the precession time itself, and that also can cut off and limit the magnitude of the resonant relaxation. And in particular, if you think of the tidal disruption, whenever the tidal radius is getting into the relativistic region, that itself is going to tend to cut off this this strong enhancement to the disruption rate for very tightly bound orbits. And you can parameterize that in terms of this way, that there's sort of some GR value of Q, where for Q smaller than that, you know, if you try to go more into the empty loss cone limit than this, then GR precession is going to cut off the resonant effects. And if you ask what whole mass do you need for GR to cut off the effect totally, that just means when is this equal to one, which, when does this extend out to the marginally full loss cone, and that turns out to be sort of 10 to the 8th solar masses. Now in terms of, you know, if you're trying to, you know, this sort of whole mass, tidal disruptions would never explain sort of the high power output that you would associate with a 10 to the 8th solar mass black hole anyway. So, I mean, this doesn't really matter in that sense.
It may give a lower bound on the tidal disruption rate.
Uh-huh.
And so if you've got a big black hole in a nearby galaxy, as most of them are, and they're not being fueled, there's a lower bound on how much gas you're supplying, albeit intermittently.
Uh-huh.
I'm not so sure it is really.
Although if you go to the other end, sort of to 10 to the 6 solar mass black holes, then this doesn't really affect the resonant argument very much. And I can show you a simulation sort of illustrating the relativistic effects. So here what I've done is essentially I've taken a single cluster and I've effectively changed the mass of the black hole, changed how close the tidal radius comes to the horizon, and so you can see that as you increase the whole mass, this is for, you know, specific value of Q in the empty loss cone case, and then as you increase the whole mass, then the resonant enhancement, which is originally like a factor of 40 or so, just gets shut off. Okay, well, those are basically the main effects. So, I mean, I think in terms of what's unresolved in this particular area, I guess this is actually a real problem because, you know, in sort of giving a few tidy view graphs, I mean, it sort of doesn't give you a sense of how difficult some of these calculations were to do. And there's actually, you know, the graphs I showed you, there are months of CPU time behind them. And even then, you know, the signal to noise isn't that great for some of them. And it's basically this problem that you have this global phenomenon with very many stars, and you can't use continuum methods at this point because this is, you know, this is no good anymore. So you're forced to use particle methods, and I think that's sort of getting around that is prerequisite to really be able to critically determine what, you know, observationally what we can expect to see and what's the real structure of the nucleus on the scales where this is important.
I think that's a very interesting issue. That's actually something I think I know a little bit about, and I'll try to think about it. I may have to wait until next time I'm on an airplane or something.
Uh-huh.
I'm not completely convinced the fog of love is dead, or to make something safe. But anyway,
yeah,
that's a very interesting question to raise.
Okay, and I mean, if somebody can think of a case where, like, say, how this could be important for globular clusters, you know, which I sort of dismissed because, you know, changing the orientations in general doesn't seem to matter, you know, let me know. But I guess the other context, of course, is planetary-type systems where it might be important. And, you know, some work has been done on that. It sort of, it can change sort of, you know, excitation modes in particle disks and so forth. And I guess Scott has a paper out looking at some of that. But, okay, so that's basically the process. And I don't know if there's any more comments, discussion?
Could you offer limits on globular clusters and conjectural large black holes in them?
Change the limits in terms of, like, by trying to use disruption.
Or if there's a fourth solar mass black hole in the center of...
Right. Well, I guess, again... Yeah, I mean, I guess since the resonant effect, you know, you already have to be well into the Keplerian regime. You know, there's this pesky Coulomb logarithm which diminishes the increase. So, I mean, it's sort of the same reason why you didn't have to take account of this to figure out that there were black holes in galactic nuclei in the first place.
Yes, right.
So I think that's probably the same for globular clusters as well.
Another crazy question, or have I used
up
We believe that galaxies are embedded in a dark matter halo, and there must even be a little bit of nearly constant density dark matter right down there in the nucleus. It's not very much, but on the other hand, you're already talking about relativistic effects, which are also not very great. So
right. It's any form of precession will limit the effect of it.
Yeah.
So it's just a matter of, I mean, outside of GR, it's just a matter of what's the relative mass.
Yeah. Right.
By each component, you know, in the nucleus, basically. And so you just have to add them all up to get what's the total precession time.
Yeah.